3, State of Minnesota versus Mohamed Farouk Mohamed Abdulaziz. This case is being heard on the Zoom platform pursuant to pandemic-related court orders. The procedures are the same as our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and or for your primary argument, and appellant will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. The marshal will be keeping time in one of the rectangles that you can view on your grid view. Hopefully you're all viewing us in grid view currently. The clock will start when you start your argument. It's not posted up there yet, but you'll see a 15-minute clock. There it is currently. When you start, that will start. If we do encounter any technical difficulties, I'll ask the marshal to stop the clock so you won't lose any time, but hopefully that won't happen. The argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals, and I'll remind you that any other recordings are not permitted except without the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. And I'll also ask counsel to identify yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. So, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Farouk Abdulaziz. Mr. Abdulaziz came to this country to build a better life. He got married, he had 2 children, became a lawful permanent resident or green card holder, and he had a good job. Then the Final Four NCAA college basketball tournament came to town in the Twin Cities. The police decided they would mount an undercover sting operation to catch people soliciting underage prostitution during the basketball tournament. The only problem is they were fishing for tuna, meaning people who actually want to solicit a minor for prostitution, and they caught a dolphin, meaning Mr. Abdulaziz, a person who did not want or intend to solicit a minor for prostitution, but he was soliciting adult prostitution. The entire nature of this sting or undercover operation is that the police lie. This is a sting or a scam or a switch, a bait and switch, and that's what they did to Mr. Abdulaziz. And the fact that they're lying is important because it gets to the element of the offense about whether he reasonably believed this person was a minor or not. He didn't answer an ad for minor prostitution. He answered an ad for adult prostitution. That is undisputed. And the ad specifically said the woman in the ad was 21, and that's in the transcript at page 57, and it's in the exhibit of the ad. Moreover, according to the police testimony at trial, the woman in the picture, whose face was blurred, was actually older than 21. So not just 21, but older than 21, because it's an undercover police officer. In order to become a police officer, by nature, by common sense, you would be older than 21 by the time you complete all your schooling. That's in the transcript of page 58. Then Mr. Abdulaziz started texting with the minor persona, who was actually an adult male over 21. The minor persona claimed to be 15 years old. So if the ad says the persona is 21, but the text message says the persona is 15, then the persona is obviously lying one time or the other. But the reader, in this case, appellant, just doesn't know which time the persona is lying. Was the persona lying when she said she was 21, or was she lying when she said she was 15? No one could possibly know. Now that's the question. In order to convict under counts 1 and 2, which is solicitation of a minor to commit prostitution and electronic sexual solicitation of a minor, a defendant must have reasonably believed that the person he was chatting or talking with was under 16, but a reasonable person could not really determine her age or the age of this persona, because we know, and he knew, and any reasonable reader knew that she lied. The appellant knew that she lied. He just didn't know which time she lied. So we would assert that there is no proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a reasonable person would think that she was 15 or under 16 in the age, the terms of the statute.
Mr. Keller, can I ask a clarifying question with regard to your argument about the sufficiency of the evidence as to age? Does that argument apply to both counts or just the second count? Your brief suggested that maybe your argument was focused on the second count, but I assume your argument actually applies to both counts.
Thank you for that question, Judge Cochran. It is intended to apply to both counts, because obviously if it were true for one count, it's equally true for the other one, because both of them would require that the person reasonably believed that they're talking or communicating with or negotiating with, or whatever words you want to use, a person who is under 16.
with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence on the age element, what standard of review should this court apply? Respondent argues we should apply the direct evidence standard of review, and I think you argue we should apply the circumstantial standard of review.
That's correct.
Substantial evidence standard of review.
That's correct, Your Honor. So basically, the state cited a bunch of different cases that have come up in the last few years when these cases have been prosecuted. And there are cases where the Court of Appeals has applied a direct evidence standard, and there's cases where the Court of Appeals has applied a circumstantial evidence standard. So we would apply that it's circumstantial evidence. I understand that the Court of Appeals has gone both ways on that. The published case says that it's direct evidence. There's unpublished cases saying that it's circumstantial evidence.
Well, would you agree that which standard applies really depends on the evidence in the case?
That's what I was about to say.
Oh, okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I interrupted you, so I apologize, but I agree. It all depends on exactly what the person said in the chat or what have you. It depends on the precise facts of the case. It would have to. Because, for instance, some people make post-Miranda statements, and actually that's an issue in this case too that I want to discuss, because I think the state has misinterpreted and kind of misstated what the appellant really said in his post-Miranda statement. Because that can be said to be some direct evidence because it's a statement by the defendant or the appellant, but also it's sort of circumstantial evidence because it goes to what the intent of the person was or what is the meaning of words. And that's part of the problem with these things, is what is the meaning of words. So on page 18 of the state's brief, it says the prosecutor asked the BCA agent, during your conversation you talked about, comma, then, that the individual said that they were 15, is that correct? ? BCA agent, correct. Prosecutor, what did the defendant say when you asked him what that meant? Now that's an ambiguous phrase right there, because we're talking about circumstantial evidence, talking about ambiguity. What did people mean when they said something? When the prosecutor says, what did the defendant say when you asked him what that meant? We don't know what that meant actually means. Then the answer is here, BCA agent, he said that it was a minor. So what I take that to mean is that the appellant was saying, if a person is 15, a person who were 15 would be a minor. He's not saying this person was a minor, but the state interprets that to mean that the appellant was saying this person is a minor. But he obviously didn't believe, when you look at his chat messages, he obviously didn't believe that the person was a minor, because when she said she was 15, he says, oh my God, you look 18 or more and your ad says 21. So he obviously didn't believe it. So I think that part of the state's brief really misapprehends what the appellant was saying, and that kind of goes to illustrate that these are really circumstantial evidence cases oftentimes, because you can't get into the mind of the defendant or the appellant, and these are subtle things by their nature, because as we were pointing out in our brief, and in the trial testimony, no one is going to put up an ad saying, will you trade money for sex? That's what the BCA said. No one's going to put up an ad saying that.
I'm just wondering, is this a do or die issue for you, the standard of review? In other words, can you prevail if we apply a direct evidence standard in analyzing the sufficiency of the evidence, or can you only prevail if we apply the more stringent circumstantial evidence standard of review?
Well, we would assert that we could prevail under either one, Your Honor, but obviously the circumstantial evidence standard is better for us. We would assert that there is a reasonable explanation for the events other than guilt under the circumstantial evidence standard. It comes down to, in part, whether you think that a reasonable person would believe that this person was under 21 or not. And I think that goes beyond the circumstantial evidence versus direct evidence standard. If you believe the state's interpretation of what I just read on page 18 of their brief, they take that to mean that the appellant arguably presented like direct evidence saying that this person was a minor, but I don't think that's what he was saying at all. He was saying if a person is 15, that person would be a minor. He didn't say, I believed that the person I was chatting with was a minor. By its nature, because the police will not put up an ad saying I'm underage, they will not put up pictures of people that are underage, they will not put up an ad saying I want to trade money for sex, then it seems like by its nature, by definition, it comes down to a circumstantial evidence case, except for some other facts that would make it a direct evidence case that I don't believe that we have in this case. I want to talk about entrapment a little bit. And
counsel, before you do that, you've been focusing on the age of the girl here, or the woman. Are you conceding the intent to engage in sexual activity, putting aside age?
We are, just as we argued to the jury, Your Honor. I think it would be dishonest for Mr. Abdulaziz to say that he didn't solicit an adult for prostitution, because I think the evidence shows that he did, and we've never really tried to argue anything else in spite of whatever inartful statements we might have put in our brief. Our position in our brief is supposed to be consistent with what we argued to the jury, which is we said, go ahead and convict him of soliciting an adult for prostitution, because he obviously did that. We asked for a lesser included offense, and the trial court granted our request for a lesser included offense of adult prostitution because he obviously did that. Now, he did make statements saying that, well, maybe I want to have a friend and companionship. Made a lot of different statements all over the board, but I think the evidence shows that he's guilty of soliciting an adult for prostitution. The problem is there's two problems. No reasonable person could really say that this is for sure a minor. That's number one. Number two is the government conceived of this crime. The government entrapped him. The government did a bait and switch because it was obviously an ad that said 21. They're very clear in their trial testimony. They would never put up an ad saying that, oh, I'm 15 and I want to trade money for sex. So by definition, the ads that the police put up are going to be dishonest.
Counsel, I understand that. I think all three of us do, since there's been many of these cases. But are you suggesting that he has to be sure that she's 15 for this to go forward? Isn't it enough that she stated she was 15? In other words, aren't you opening up quite a door here that to suggest that anybody in this situation can say, well, I didn't believe she was 15, so you can't come after me? Well,
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Cleary. So it's not enough just to say, I didn't believe it. I think the question under the law is, what would a reasonable person believe? And that's what the statute says, is that a defendant has to have a reasonable belief that the person was under 16 in order to be convicted of an under 16 crime. So I think the question is, what would a reasonable person believe under these circumstances? Now, we can argue, we can disagree about what a reasonable person would believe, but that's our position. And so, you know, there's circumstantial evidence that he didn't believe it. So it's not just his assertion by, say, pleading not guilty or making an argument that, well, the evidence is insufficient on this element. There is circumstantial evidence, and what he said to the police, which is part of the evidence, or to the persona, what he said to the persona, which is part of the evidence in this case, that he said, oh my God, that doesn't sound right. You don't look 15, you look 18, and your ad says 21. So that goes to our entrapment argument. This crime was completely conceived in the mind of the government. They say that this is a demand reduction sting, and it's really not a demand reduction sting. It's actually a demand increase sting, because it's increasing demand for adult prostitution, because that's the ad that they put up there.
Counsel, putting aside your argument there, which was in front of us, the problem with the entrapment in terms of trying to show pressure or badgering is that the police officer playing the underage girl here said, K, bye, that quote, K, bye. In other words, she was cutting off the phone conversation. Your client at that point kept it going, and keeping the conversation going and negotiating and talking about raw or with cover after knowing that she's 15 is what gets him where he is today, correct? And where's the entrapment? Where's the badgering, the pressure?
Well, thank you, Judge Cleary, for that question. So obviously there's a lot of things back and forth that are said. Some of the things are better for Mr. Abdulaziz, and some of them are not so good for him. So the undercover officer gave him a chance to get out at that point. Then Mr. Abdulaziz reengaged, but there's also times later on where maybe Mr. Abdulaziz was not going to show up. And then the undercover officer says, come on, basically. Now I'm paraphrasing, but he says, like, come on, you're wasting my time here. Are you going to show up or what? So we would assert that there is more badgering, there is more pressuring later on, but I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Petras, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Keller. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I'm representing the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. I would like to briefly touch on 3 points this morning, and then I'm happy to try to address any questions that this court has about any of the aspects of the case. Those 3 points are the appropriate standard of review, and note. Then number 2 would be to note which evidence from the trial record this court can consider on review. And then 3rd, I do want to make 1 point, if possible, about the entrapment issue. So to begin talking about the standard of review, I want to clarify my position, because upon rereading my brief to get ready for today, I don't think I was as clear as I would have liked about the state's position. In my brief, I suggest there's tension between recent decisions of this court regarding the appropriate standard of review to apply when reviewing sufficiency of the evidence claims following convictions for prostitution of a minor and electronic solicitation of a child. And Judge Cochran, I know that you are especially familiar with these prior cases, given that you authored the opinion in 2 of them, in both Conley and then Onu Oha. Those 2 particular cases, of course, apply different standards of review to sufficiency claims, even though those cases were very similar in many respects. But I think you and Mr. Keller just discussed really what is the difference between those 2 cases and the reason that this court applied the traditional standard in Conley and then the circumstantial evidence standard in Onu Oha. It's because the specific evidence that was presented in each of those cases. So in Khan Lee, this court concluded that the defendant's convictions were sufficiently proven by direct evidence, and the court identified text messages that the defendant sent and his statements to police in a post-Miranda interview as direct evidence, and that those demonstrated or established the defendant's intent and his reasonable belief as to the fictional persona's age. In contrast, in Onu Oha, this court concluded that the defendant's text messages did not directly demonstrate his belief regarding the fictional persona's age or his intent because, and unlike in this case, in Onu Oha, the defendant never described the sexual service that he wanted in the text, and he never made any admissions to police afterwards. Now, the specific evidence in this case, in the appellant's case, the substance of the text conversations, and then appellant's admission, which we can get to during his post-Miranda interview, they constitute the direct evidence that this court recognized in Khan Lee. And what I'm talking about specifically is identifying the sexual service, in this case, oral sex, that the defendant did in his, or the appellant did, excuse me, in his text message. And notably, that was not, that was an answer to an open-ended question that was posed by the fictional persona, saying, what would you like to happen, or what would you, what are you interested in? And so it was appellant who obviously brought up the sexual service at that point in the text conversation. Now, this at this point in the text conversation was before the fictional persona had identified herself as a 15-year-old. But if we go back to after that point in the conversation, then you have the appellant renegotiating the price down to $100 after thinking or being told that he was dealing with a 15-year-old girl. And of course, as Judge Cleary just mentioned, you have him clarifying or determining whether or not a condom would be required. Again, after he was told that the person he was communicating with was 15 years old. That's direct evidence that establishes the intent. In terms
Mr.
of
Petrus,
age—
I wanna ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Keller, and that is whether the outcome of this case from your perspective depends on the standard of review that we would apply.
And I have the same answer as Mr. Keller, and I don't think it does. I think the state prevails under either standard. I think the appropriate standard would be what this court did in Conley, but I think under either the traditional standard or the circumstantial evidence standard that this court has to reach the conclusion that there was sufficient evidence. And I can make that point under a circumstantial argument with respect to age. So you have the defendant, you know, being, I guess I would interpret the, as I wrote in my brief, his admission during the Miranda interview to be an admission that he was dealing or interacting with a 15-year-old. And I had the attempt to separate appellant's statement about what being 15 years old meant to appellant from his alleged rejection of that meeting inside his own head in this particular case, I don't think that's a reasonable distinction to draw. I mean, if appellant had honestly not believed that the fictional persona was 15 years old, even after being told that she was 15 years old, he could have said that when discussing this in his post-Miranda interview, and he did not. And I think other circumstances, Judge Gaetis, going to that analysis, that would reinforce that point is the fact that after being told that he was interacting with a 15-year-old, that's when he tried to renegotiate the price down to $100. And he asked three separate times if the fictional persona was associated with law enforcement. He had not inquired at all about whether the fictional persona was associated with law enforcement before being told that she was 15 years old, which clearly means that the statement that I'm 15 years old had an impact on appellant.
Mr. Petrus. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Thank you. Do the questions that he posed about being associated with law enforcement, does that indicate some doubt rather than a belief that the person was actually 15?
I don't believe so. I think it's evidence of a guilty mind, and worried that if he's actually interacting with a 15-year-old, this could be, you know, some sort of operation where he's being led. Posed with a situation that is a far more serious crime than the one he was intending to commit. Obviously, he went ahead with it anyway, in terms of, you know, renegotiating the price, asking if a condom was required, you know, asking for the address on repeated instances, and then ultimately going to the hotel room. But I think the inquiries about law enforcement circumstantially indicate that he knew that he was dealing with a 15-year-old and that that was more wrong under the law.
And so my question was, I just wanted to be clear, the statements that you referenced about, you know, whether this person was law enforcement, you know, the statement made to law enforcement, are you arguing that those are direct evidence, or are you arguing that those are circumstantial evidence of his reasonable belief?
That's a great clarifying question. I'm sorry for being confusing on that. I think that those specific statements, that is, the appellant's repeated questions to the fictional persona about whether the fictional persona was associated with law enforcement, those would be circumstantial evidence supporting the reasonable belief as to the fictional persona's age. I think the direct evidence as to his reasonable belief about her age would come in the post-Miranda interview, which was that colloquy that I isolated on page 18 of my brief, as Mr. Keller referenced. But I think that direct evidence itself is enough to establish his reasonable belief. And so that is why I think this court should apply in this particular case with these specific facts, the traditional standard of review. And I do want to make the point too, that regardless of which standard of review that this court applies, that it must disregard all of the evidence that is inconsistent with the guilty verdicts. And I guess that means that appellant's suggestions via text that the female was older than 15 years old, and specifically the suggestion via text that maybe that appellant and the 15-year-old could just be friends, those cannot be considered by this court on sufficiency review under either standard. They're inconsistent with the verdict, which means that the jury rejected the sincerity or the credibility of those suggestions by appellant. And on appeal, we all must defer to the jury's factual determinations on those points. And then the last point I want to make on the entrapment issue is just in terms of kind of building on what Judge Cleary was saying before about the first step of that two-step entrapment analysis, which is that the defendant has the burden to establish some sort of pressuring or persuasion or badgering by the state. And the two isolated statements that say, "You coming or what?" and then, "You coming or not?" those were questions by the fictional persona that was merely another opportunity for appellant to back out after being told he was communicating with a 15-year-old girl. And of course, it was phrased in a way that the detective felt that a 15-year-old girl would be likely to say it in. Now, if that fictional persona had repeatedly sent text messages along the lines of, "You know you want me," or had graphically described some of the sexual things that the fictional persona allegedly wanted to do to appellant, well, that could have amounted to persuasion or pressure. But we are nowhere close to that threshold based on the specific facts in this case. And I see I have a few minutes left. I am more than happy to try to answer questions either about the sufficiency claims or about the entrapment issue.
Any further questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Petrus, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name earlier.
It happens a lot, no worries. I'd simply ask in conclusion that you affirm appellant's convictions in this case.
Thank you. Any rebuttal, Mr. Keller?
Thank you, Your Honor. So The case law we cited in our brief, it says officers of the law shall not incite crime to punish its perpetrator and shall not lead a person into crime. The jury was correctly instructed on the affirmative defense of entrapment. And that instruction is, if the criminal design does not originate with the person, but is conceived in the mind of a government agent, and the person is, by coercion, persuasion, deceitful representation, or inducement, lured into committing an act the person otherwise would not have committed or had no intention of committing, then it is entrapment. And the law says the defendant must raise an entrapment defense by establishing by a fair preponderance of the evidence that a government actor initiated the crime idea. I think we've established that through the trial testimony. And first, the defendant has to show by fair preponderance of the evidence that the government engaged in inducement. And if that is shown, which would be by persuasion, badgering, or pressure by the state, as Judge Cleary and the state's counsel here just mentioned, then if that first step is established, then the state has to show by beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was predisposed to commit the crime charge. So obviously this originated in the mind of the state. They said, oh, there's a Final Four basketball tournament on, let's put up this ad. The ad's obviously false because it says it's 21. They're trying to entrap people who want to commit adult prostitution and so, get them to agree to minor prostitution.
Mr. Keller, I'm just wondering if during the limited amount of time we have left, I could actually take you back to the sufficiency issue and the standard of review. Mr. Petras argued that in determining the circumstances proved, if we were to apply that circumstantial evidence standard of review, we would have to disregard some of the evidence that you have brought to our attention as part of your argument that there wasn't sufficient evidence of reasonable belief, including the statement of surprise when this persona sent or disclosed age. What is your position? Is that a circumstance proved? Or is that something that we have to disregard in our analysis?
Well, thank you for that question, Judge. I put down some notes about what the government's counsel was saying about all of that. So I would say absolutely not, that the court is not obliged, nor should it ignore those facts, because they're not facts that were... the facts are all undisputed, basically. The chat messages are what the chat messages are. No one disputes that that's what the conversation was in the chat messages. Now, you can argue about what they meant, but obviously the defendant appellant was surprised. He said, oh my God, well, you look like 18 plus. We know the ad says 21.
So I think I know your answer, which is that those comprise the circumstances proved. So just one follow-up question. So continuing with the assumption that we were to apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review, what is the reasonable hypothesis of innocence?
Well, the reasonable hypothesis for innocence, thank you for that question, Your Honor, is that basically he was intending to commit the crime of adult prostitution. He was not intending or attempting to commit the crime of minor prostitution or minor electronic solicitation. Because if it's true that he reasonably believed that this person was not a minor, and that a reasonable person in his shoes would not believe that this person was a minor, then he couldn't be guilty. So to me, the reasonable hypothesis other than guilt is that he thought that he was talking to an adult, because an adult could claim to be a minor and a minor could claim to be an adult. All we know for sure is that this person lied. We don't know when they lied. So, of course, the government argues in cases all the time that when we know that someone lied, then you just disregard everything that they have to say because you really can't trust them. So I agree with the state that when he expressed surprise and everything, that's circumstantial evidence. And I agree that what someone says in a post-Miranda statement is direct evidence. I just don't agree with their interpretation of what his post-Miranda statement means. It's very vague. The questions were not asked. The state says he didn't say certain things in his post-Miranda statement. Well, he wasn't asked those questions, but I see my time has expired. So we'd ask that you reverse the convictions on counts 1 and 2. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments here today. We appreciate your responses to our questions, and the case is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the 90-day statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.